This Two Lectures episode features author of The Wisdom of Birds, Tim Birkhead, recorded live at the global event in Cardigan, West Wales in 2009.
Okay, I'm an academic. I teach at the University of Sheffield. I teach animal behaviour, I teach evolution, and I teach a little bit about the history and philosophy of science. And I've been a bird watcher since I was this big, and I was encouraged by my dad to be a bird watcher. And I suspect by the time I got to about 13 or 14, he was beginning to wonder what he'd done to me, because I used to bunk off school to go bird watching, and I kept birds in an aviary in the garden. And at one point, he took me to one side and he said, "Look, you're never going to make a living out of doing this. Pull your socks up and get on with your scholarly studies." And being as awkward a bugger as he was, I decided to try and prove him wrong. And I think I was just very fortunate in that the British education system then was in a phase of expansion, which allowed somebody who was just a keen bird watcher to actually become a professional zoologist. So I spent my life studying birds. And I've studied the reproductive biology of birds, the evolution of birds. And as time went on, I became increasingly fascinated by the question of how we know what we know about birds. So if somebody took you on a bird walk and you heard a bird singing and they say, "Well, it's defending its territory," how do we know it's defending its territory? Where did that knowledge come from? And so a few years ago, I decided I'd try and find out where that knowledge of birds came from. And of course, the obvious place to start was in libraries. And when you started to look at the history of what we know about birds, it went back a long way. It went back to the Greeks, basically, Aristotle and so on. But things didn't really start happening in Europe until about 1500. And the thing that amazed me about these old books, and some of them are in libraries, mainly in the valuable section of the library, so you can't get easy access, but also a few nutters have fabulous collections of books, and if you treat them right, they're very proud to show you their fantastic collections. And this is one owned by Lord Derby at Knowsley Hall. And when I started looking inside these books, I began to realize that a lot of these collections were of books like this, where there were fabulous illustrations, but nobody ever read the text. Nobody had looked at what these early writers about birds had done. The first thing that struck me when I started reading was that most of our early knowledge of birds came from keeping birds. Now, this is a big no-no today. The RSPB have successfully brainwashed us into thinking anything to do with keeping birds is wrong. You can't even think about keeping birds. You can't even think about what people did in the past about keeping birds. And so it's kind of been obliterated from our kind of collective consciousness. But in fact, the history of ornithology in terms of keeping birds is just an amazingly rich vein of stuff. And one of the things that happened to me was, as I got more and more into this, it's just a complete pain in the bum to continually be going to Oxford or Cambridge to get access to those rare books. You can just click on Bookfinder or something. I started to buy them. I never told my wife I was spending all our money on this. And then, you know, once you start buying them, people say, "Have you seen such and such is for sale?" And you go and look at the price. "Oh, right, okay," click, and off you go. And then people started going to auctions for me, and I'd made lists of what I wanted. And on one occasion, the guy came, went to an auction for me, and months later, this package arrived in the post. I went through the books, and I kind of vaguely remembered ordering this one and this one. And then this book, Traite de Rossignol, Treatise on a Nightingale, was in amongst the books that were sent. And I went, "Oh, no recollection. I don't even know this book." And I looked it up, and it was an incredibly scarce book. And it was 30 quid, you know. It was incredibly rare. It's written in 1707. And to add insult, injury to insult, I can't even read French, so it was kind of completely useless. But luckily, I'd got a good batch of international PhD students, and I got this girl to start translating it. And as she translated, I realized that this book was a kind of turning point in the history of ornithology. It was an absolute goldmine of knowledge. Nightingales were the most popular cage bird. They have this fabulous song, and this is in the days before iPods and iPhones, And people kept birds in their houses as a kind of medieval radio. That's what it was there for. And the nightingale, you know, is the ultimate songster. I don't know if you can crank that up a bit. One of my most poignant memories was one of my PhD students. His parents were very grateful for him getting a PhD. They must have thought, like me, he was a bit of a loser, and he made it. And they invited me and my wife to Italy as a kind of thank you. And part of this trip was to go to the island of Giglio, which is just south of Elba. And we stayed in a little bed and breakfast place, you know, on a wooded hillside, an exquisitely beautiful place. We arrived there at dusk, and the plan was to go over to Giglio the next day. And as I got into bed, there was a nightingale in the garden, and it was closer than you are now, and it started singing like that. And in contrast to last night, this thing kept me awake. This thing kept me awake in a state of euphoria for the whole night. And the song was so powerful, and the bird was so close, and they sing very loud, I could feel it in my chest. And I kind of drifted in and out of sleep while this bird was singing. It's an unpaired male, it's only the unpaired males that sing at night, was singing for its partner. And it was just the most fantastic experience ever. Because people kept birds principally for their song, careful observers started to notice really interesting things about bird song. And all sorts of birds were kept. Sometimes, like the bullfinch, they were kept principally for their appearance. This is one of Britain's most beautiful birds. I don't think we need this spider here. But the bullfinch has, if I can find the mouse on here, has probably the worst song of any bird at all. So here it is.
Bullfinch.
You have to get this bit on the tape. That's not me. Listen. That's it. That's the bullfinch's song, okay? It's been likened to a squeaky wheelbarrow. But there's something very strange and very special about the bullfinch. Somebody earlier asked me what my favourite bird is. The bullfinch is my favourite bird, without doubt. In the 1850s, and this had been known for the previous 300 years, people kept bullfinches because, despite that awful song, they have the most remarkable facility for learning songs that they hear. And there was a little industry amongst the foresters in Germany of taking nestling bullfinches, hand-rearing them, and then a forester would whistle a particular tune to them, and the bird would learn it. And there would be things like this, "Thou art so like a flower." I can't whistle that, but that's the kind of thing they did. And prior to that, people had also recognized that if you played them a tune on a flageolet like this, they could learn it as well. So here's a friend of mine playing that. Well, not that piece of music, another piece of music. And there was a very popular book full of flageolet music like this, specifically for you to train your bird. It was a complete scam. There was no way a bird could ever learn anything as complicated as that. But this is what they could learn. So this first recording I'm going to play you is of a German forester whistling the tune he wants his bullfinch to learn. It's in German. So this is somebody telling the German guy to whistle it. So he goes. Okay, so enough of that. Oops, hang on. And now this is the bird singing it, whistling it. The amazing thing is the bird just does it so much better. And, and you also probably notice the bird always shifts up a semitone. Nobody knows why they do it at all. A really good bird, and it's only the male, so this was a desperately unprofitable business. You'd start off with a bunch of chicks, you'd hand-rear them, you'd whistle to them. 15 times a day for 6 months. It was not easy work. Half of them would be females, they would be rubbish, you'd chuck them out, and only a proportion of the males would learn the song. And a very small number could sing three of those kind of tunes. Not only that, these birds became incredibly popular. Queen Victoria had one, the Russian Tsar had one, and the Victorian supermodel Lizzie Siddle had one. Everybody, you know, it's like having an iPod today. It was a great status symbol to have one of these birds, and if it could sing three folk songs, it was fantastic. Not only were these birds amazing at repeating these songs, and if you had a three singer, it would cost you about 5,000 quid in today's money. Phenomenally expensive. Not only that, these birds formed the most remarkable relationship with their owner. So this guy is Jürgen Nicolai, who was a German ornithologist who worked with Konrad Lorenz in the 50s and 60s, who made understanding song learning in bullfinches the main topic of his research. And here he is with a bullfinch that's halfway through its training.
Zoologen Dr. Jürgen Nicolai, dann ist er auf den Menschen geprägt und wird ihn einem Dompfaffweibchen stets vorziehen. In dieser Zeit hat er sogar einen artfremden Gesang gelernt. Er balzt sein vermeintliches Weibchen mit einem Volkslied an.
This is a bird whistling. Just like a child learning a nursery rhyme, if it gets it wrong, it goes back to the beginning. And when they're on their own, these birds practice and practice and practice. They're so motivated to learn this. And you can see that this bird is completely in love with him. He's in love with the bird as well. They're both imprinted. And the amazing thing is, because it was always foresters, men, who trained these birds to sing, the bullfinches were almost always imprinted on their subsequent male owner. So often ladies would buy these birds and they'd go, doesn't sing. The husband would come in, the bullfinch would go, oh, I like you, and start singing. But you can see there's an incredible affection between the owner and the bird there. And that was the other aspect of this that made these birds so utterly charming. Well, enough of that. I'll move on. So lots of biologists have studied bird song, partly inspired by things like that. And in today's climate, the government is looking very closely at the kind of research that they fund. And they think that things like studying birdsong is kind of frivolous research. What possible economic benefits could there be from that? But in fact, birdsong is one of the most powerful examples of why you should fund frivolous research, because the study of birdsong holds the promise of a cure for Alzheimer's. Nightingales were a complete pain in the bum to keep. They needed live food, they had wet feces, so they were very messy. When the canary came along, the canary displaced the nightingale as the cage bird. And it too, you could train it to sing all sorts of stuff. Not quite as affectionate as a bullfinch, but they were a good pet, and people still keep them today for their song. Just like the bullfinch, though, only males sing. And when, in about 1940, artificial or synthetic testosterone was made, unscrupulous canary breeders got their hands on this, and they would give their female canaries a shot of testosterone. And remarkably, because females never sing, these birds would then burst into song. And it was fairly short-lived, and then when the testosterone wore off, the birds stopped singing. In the 1970s, somebody thought, this is actually pretty amazing stuff. Here's a bird that never normally sings. You give it a hormone and it can sing just as well as any male canary. What on earth is going on in the brain? And when they started looking inside the bird's brain, they discovered something that they thought just was totally impossible. So the conventional wisdom was the neurons in our brain that we're born with are the ones we will die with. That's why if you had a traffic accident and you get head injury, you've had it, basically. What happened in canaries was, you gave these females a shot of testosterone and new neurons grew and allowed the bird to sing. People thought that was totally impossible. So this one frivolous study of canaries changed the whole of neurobiology, because if we can find the secret of how you make new neurons grow, then you can repair brain damage from things like Alzheimer's or even road traffic accidents. Okay, so there's a long preamble there about song. This little book also had very careful observations about migration. At that time, people thought that birds hibernated. People even thought that things like swallows spent the winter in the mud at the bottom of ponds. Here's some Swedish guys hauling a net in that's got a combination of swallows and fish. And I think that image was incredibly powerful in impressing that idea onto people's minds. You know, it's a bit like having a digital photo. I've seen the evidence. You know, it's a little woodcut from the 1550s. I know it's true that swallows hibernate in the mud. And that idea persisted through till about 1850. It took a long time to get rid of. Even our own beloved Gilbert White added fuel to this because he couldn't quite bring himself to think that swallows migrated. It took a scientist, a contemporary of Gilbert White's in Germany, to do a little experiment to demonstrate that that wasn't true. He tied coloured threads around the legs of his swallows that were breeding in his barn, and very cunningly he said, and I used a water-soluble dye, so if, when they come back next year, if that dye's gone, then that will suggest that they have indeed been in water over winter. If the colour is still there, then that will demonstrate that they haven't. And that's exactly, of course, what he found out. I'm also interested in the reproductive biology of birds. That's my main kind of research topic. And this little bird that I studied in Poland about 10 years ago was a kind of a moment that changed my life. If you look at the common garden birds that you're all familiar with, the robin, house sparrow and blackbird, and you do a molecular study on the chicks in their nest and see whether there's a mismatch, you'll find that about 10% of the offspring have been fathered by the milkman. It's exactly the same in humans, not necessarily the milkman, but 10% is the same figure. If you do that same analysis for the aquatic warbler, they have about 6 chicks on average. In half the nests that we looked at, every chick had a different dad. That's promiscuity for you. Now, in evolutionary terms, males are obsessed by maintaining their paternity, so we expect aquatic warblers to have some fantastic adaptations to secure their paternity, and indeed they do. This is a bird that I dissected. A friend of mine had them in captivity and one died. When you dissect an aquatic warbler in the breeding season, there is nothing inside a male aquatic warbler other than testes. So in birds, the testes are in the body cavity where our kidneys would be. So these are the testes, and these structures here are called the seminal glomera. They're equivalent to our epididymis, which in human males are wrapped around the testes. So these testes are huge. And just to put it in kind of human context, well, no, I'm not going to leave that. The other thing that these birds do is, I don't know if any of you have ever seen birds copulating in the garden at home, but most birds, like blackbirds and so on, copulate in 1 or 2 seconds. The aquatic warbler is a record breaker, 10,000 times that long, 35 minutes. That's pretty good going, even by human standards, I guess. made me ask, okay, who was it that first recognise that birds have territories, breeders, pairs, and that large testes are a sure sign of female promiscuity, because males don't need those adaptations if females are not promiscuous. I wondered whether the greatest ornithologist ever might have the answer to that, and I asked my ornithological colleagues who they thought the greatest ornithologist ever was, and they came up with all sorts of names of 20th century people. And my view was that this guy, John Ray, was the greatest, not just ornithologist, but greatest naturalist ever. He really was a just incredibly clear-thinking guy. And together with his tutee, Francis Willoughby, a wealthy member of the aristocracy, they decided they were going to overhaul the whole of British natural history. Up until that time, all natural history had been based on what we can call emblematics, kind of folklore, unscientific stuff. So this little emblem here, as you can see, is a pelican piercing its own breast to feed its young on its own blood in an act of self-sacrifice. And John Ray and Francis Willoughby knew that this was twaddle and wanted to have a more scientific outlook. So they went on a grand tour and after several years produced this book, It's called The Ornithology of Francis Willoughby because poor old Willoughby died at the age of 37 and John Ray was left to produce it on his own. And the common conventional wisdom is that he named this book for Willoughby as a kind of dedication. The more realistic interpretation is that Willoughby's widow insisted on that, and Ray was kind of kept on in the house as a kind of servant, but he was an intellectual servant. So they produce this book, and it's fantastic text and fabulous drawings, engravings, except John Ray was very disappointed with the quality of illustrations that the engravers were able to come up with. They'd gone to a lot of trouble to secure good illustrations as models for the engravers. And then you got this. So you can recognize some of these. There's a tawny owl here, there's a nightjar here, this is an alpine swift. But there are these funny things here, which are from somebody else's book, from a guy called Margrave. And this bird, for 25 years, completely puzzled me. What the hell is this? Was this some kind of mythical South American bird? It's got two eyes. I just couldn't get my head around what's going on. I went back to Margrave's original, 1648, and it's there. You know, it's exactly the same. And then by a chance encounter, somebody told me that the painting, so what would happen on these trips is that they'd always take an artist who would do the paintings, and then the paintings would be given to the engraver who would then do this. The original paintings from this expedition were still in Brazil, in South America, and I got hold of the image that this bizarre bird here was based on, and suddenly all was revealed, and I couldn't believe how stupid I'd been. There is, and it's a little nightjar, with its beak open. Nightjars have this enormous beak for catching moths when they're flying around. And you can see how the artist must have gone, you know, who knew nothing, the engraver, who knew nothing about birds. What the hell is going on here? Okay, and that was what he did. Anyway, that's just a sideline. Now, John Ray produced another book called The Wisdom of God. And this was a kind of synthesis of all his ideas over his lifetime. And up until that point, everybody believed that God was somebody you should be frightened of. And John Ray said, no, God is a friendly guy. He's put nature there for our benefit. We shouldn't be terrified by him. And Ray called this physico-theology. It became later known as natural theology. And it was about the natural world providing evidence for the existence of God. Some people, like all new ideas, took things to extremes and they went, well, you know, here's some good evidence for the wisdom of God. God made horse shit smell sweet because he knew men would spend a lot of time working around horses. So that was, thank you, God, that's great. And God also made domesticated animals very variable in their coat colour, so every man should know his own beasts. John Ray realised that that was twaddle and focused on much more important questions. Why is it that the crossbill lays its eggs in February and the bullfinch lays its eggs in May? And John Ray had the answer, because that's the time when those chicks hatch that there's most food available. Similarly, John Ray said, why is it that eagles lay one egg, blue tits and great tits lay 12 eggs? And again, he'd got the answer. That's the maximum number of chicks that those particular species can raise. Now, Ray interpreted all this in terms of God's wisdom. But basically, he was talking about what today we call adaptation. And if you just substitute natural selection for God, Ray was an incredibly modern ornithologist. Ray was also an incredibly good scientist, because if he came across something that he couldn't understand, he didn't come up with some religious bullshit to cover up. He was completely honest. And one of the questions was, why should there be implanted in each sex such a vehement and inexpugnable appetite of copulation? Some of you may be familiar with this sensation. Ray also said, why do males produce so many sperm when only one is necessary? This seems like a very wasteful God. And he just said, I will leave that to future generations to solve. And of course, eventually, that kind of natural theology where God was the driving force gradually became replaced by natural selection and Darwin's ideas. But it's important to notice that when Darwin was a young man, that natural theology was required reading for a Cambridge undergraduate. And Darwin wrote, the old argument from design in nature, that's natural theology, which formerly seemed to me to be so conclusive, fails now that the law of natural selection has been discovered. John Ray and Francis Willoughby came within a whisker of understanding this. So when they write about the European quail in their encyclopedia, the cock has great testicles for the bigness of its body, whence we may infer it is a salacious bird. Absolutely right. They have a weird mating system, rather like the aquatic warbler. We now know, of course, that natural selection explains all these traits. And on the basis of what I've been saying, you might imagine that 1859 comes along, the Origin is published, all of that was kind of done and dusted in 1859, but it wasn't. It took until about 1980 for these things to be resolved. And I puzzled about why that should be. Darwin kind of knew that some birds were promiscuous, yet he never wrote about it. And I think there are four reasons for that. First is Queen Victoria. With Queen Victoria looking over her shoulder at you in that kind of way, it would be a brave man that started writing about female promiscuity. Secondly, Darwin's granddad was an expert in sperm competition in his own right. He'd fathered illegitimate children all over the place. He was a doctor and prescribed vigorous sex for his female hypochondriac patients, saying, "What you need, my dear, is a jolly good night out on the town," or something like that. And the third was Darwin's publisher, who pleaded with him not to use the word sex in the title of his book, his second book, The Descent of Man and Selection in Relation to Sex. John Murray said, "For God's sake, just take that word out." Luckily, Darwin stuck to his guns. The fourth, and probably the most powerful influence on Darwin's reluctance to engage in this topic, with the women folk in his life, his wife, Emma, and his daughter, Etty. Now, Etty, like a lot of young people today, kind of hang about at home. And unlike a lot of young people today, she actually made herself useful. And she helped her dad do the proofs of his book. But she also acted as his censor. So if Darwin wrote something she disapproved of, she did exactly what my daughters would do and go, "Oh, Dad, you can't say that," you know, and she would cross it out. And we know that that's true because when Darwin wrote a little biography of his granddad, he referred to granddad's ardent love of women, meaning he was a randy old sod, and she made him take it out. And we know that that's true because we've got Darwin's original manuscript, and it's got her red crayon through it, and then there's the published version where those lines don't appear. And you get a sense of what Darwin was up against with Etty when you realise that in later life, single-handedly, she started a campaign to have one particular fungus removed from the British countryside because she thought this would be a bad influence on the maids. Now, if you or I were going to remove Phallus impudicus, is its fabulous scientific name, if you were going to remove this from the countryside, I think what you'd do is you'd walk around, you'd smell it first, it's called the stink horn, and I think I would just squash it with my foot, but Etty didn't do that. She picked them up, she handled them, and she brought them back in a basket covered in a napkin, and she burnt them in the privacy of her own study. You know, Darwin, there was no chance he was ever going to talk about promiscuity. And on that note, I'll finish.
The Do Lectures is here to share stories of remarkable people in the hope they will inspire you to go and do amazing things too. There are over 300 talks to listen to, or if you prefer, watch on our website, thedolectures.com. Hit the subscribe button on your favourite podcast platform to get the latest episodes when they come out.